Today is June 20th, 2018. Tomorrow is the first day of summer. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are slightly different. Highly sensitive encrypted email at risk of exposure. PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy, is an encryption program that provides cryptographic privacy and authentication for data communication. It was developed by Phil Zimmerman back in 1991. PGP generates a public key to encrypt messages and a private key to decrypt messages. OpenPGP is an email encryption standard. A newfound flaw in email clients that use PGP and S/MIME to encrypt messages can be exploited to expose the plain text of the missive. According to a paper published by a team of researchers from three European universities, by injecting malicious snippets of text into encrypted messages, attackers can use the flaw to make the email client exfiltrate decrypted copies of the emails. Malicious actions is triggered as soon as a recipient opens a single crafted email from an attacker. The software defect was found in 23 of 35 S/MIME clients and in 10 of 28 PGP clients tested. Example of what is a PG client? Thunderbird, Apple Mail, Open Keychain, Android Privacy Guard, TrueCrypt, BitLocker, and many others. While it is necessary to change the OpenPGP and S/MIME standards to fix these vulnerabilities, some clients had even more severe implementation flaws, allowing straightforward exfiltration of the plain text. Phil Zimmerman noted that although the issue is serious, it has to do more with buggy clients at the host than with OpenPGP. Some email clients fail to use the encryption protocol's native features to stymie the kind of attack described by the researchers. There's some checking that goes on in PGP, but if the email client reacts to the news delivered by PGP that something has been hampered with, then everything will be okay. But if the client ignores that information, then you get this vulnerability. A patch to address the flaw already has been made for the Thunderbird email client, but not yet for Apple Mail. The patch doesn't close the vulnerability, it just makes it impossible to exploit it on a client. Emails that are sent from a client are still exploitable. It fixes the receiving end of the vulnerability, but it doesn't fix the underlying vulnerability in the protocol, which remains. When that underlying problem is fixed, it likely won't be backward compatible. Since only a small percentage of email users employ a PGP or S/MIME client, the threat the flaw poses to all users isn't as severe as it could be. However, it is extremely severe for the vulnerable users and their correspondents, as this threat offers a way for an attacker to access clear text content of communication meant to be secure. Of the more than 3 billion email users in the world, only tens of millions use PGP mail. Those that use it, however, are people like journalists, system administrators, and at big companies. So the type of information that is sent via PGP is usually the most sensitive. It needs to be secure. Adding to the severity of the attack is its ability to access past emails. The victim's mail client can be used as a tool to decrypt old emails that have been sent or received, and that's pretty bad. That's pretty severe. For users concerned about the security of their PGP or S/MIME email clients, well, stop using the vulnerable email clients to decrypt emails. Use a standalone application. Disable HTML rendering and automatic remote content in your email client. This will block the back-channel communication mechanism used by the flaw to infiltrate clear text data. Look for updates. It is expected that vendors will issue patches to correct some of the flaws exposed by the researchers. This was covered a few weeks ago, but it is worth repeating. There is a website, www.haveibeenpwned.com. You enter your email address and it will determine what dark web group may have your email address. You can also enter your password. The entry itself is encrypted and it will check to see if the password is in the library stored in the dark web. If it exists in the dark web, change the password and make sure it is unique. The dark web has this massive library of passwords that is used for brute force hacking. On June 7th, less than 2 weeks ago, Sprint was offering an unlimited plan for $15 if you were porting each line from another carrier. Sprint's offer was for unlimited data, calling, and texting. Sprint was hoping to draw attention when it introduced promotion to lure customers from Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile. It worked. It worked so well, it was ended in less than a week. Sprint ended the $15 per month unlimited promotion plan June 13th, and Sprint would not comment on how many people have taken advantage of the promotion. Those who have gotten into the promotion or who signed up before it expired will be able to keep the $15 per month rate. Not to be outdone, AT&T raised the price of grandfathered unlimited plans to $45. Hey, I thought competition resulted in lower prices, not raising prices. Well, and now we've heard from Verizon. They offered a new pricier unlimited plan with even more high-speed data. The carrier also let you mix and match different unlimited data options within the same family plan. But the way Verizon has explained it, it muddled the definition of the word unlimited. They introduced a third more expensive tier titled Above Unlimited. This comes on top of Go Unlimited and Beyond Unlimited with varying degrees of, well, different features. The nation's largest wireless carrier is also shaking up how you choose your plan, allowing you to mix and match different tiers within the same family plan. It's an acknowledgement that not everyone in the family has the same wireless needs. The result is a lot more options for customer, if not more confusion. Ronan Dunn, the president of Verizon Wireless, said, "It's very simple. We're confident people will enjoy the choice." Well, how do the new plans work? For your reference, here's a breakdown of all the plans, as best as I can understand it. Note that the prices and details for the first two tiers haven't really changed. Starting with Go Unlimited, the lowest tier, which includes unlimited data, but streaming video and mobile hotspot speeds at 600 kilobits per second, which is slow. Prices range from $40 to $75 per line, depending on the number of lines. Next step up is Beyond Unlimited. And Beyond Unlimited is high-definition video for up to 22 gigabytes before Verizon will throttle you, and the mobile hotspot speed is up to 15 gigabytes of usage. Price range from $50 to $85 per line. And then the top of the line, Above Unlimited. The new plan includes unlimited data with high-definition video for up to 75 gigabytes before Verizon starts throttling you, as well as 20 gigabytes of mobile hotspot data at LTE speeds. And then there are 5 travel passes, with each offers a day of international data usage per month and 500 gigabytes of Verizon cloud service. Prices range from $60 to $95 per line. Well, when you say prices range per line, well, how does it range? Verizon's new phone plan proves that it has no idea what the word unlimited really means. Wireless carriers have already demonstrated an inability to understand what unlimited actually means, offering phone plans that habitually throttle customers who use more than 26 gigabytes or so of data every month. However, with the release of the Above Unlimited plan, Verizon is pushing the mental gymnastics that carrier employed to define the word unlimited to a different level of definition. Beyond Unlimited plan is their top of 22 gigabytes of data and at a lot slower speed. Above the unlimited plan is the 75 gigabytes of unlimited data per month, along with 20 gigabytes of unlimited data when using your phone as a hotspot, and 5 monthly international travel passes, which are daily vouchers, and 5 monthly international travel passes, which are daily vouchers that let you use your phone's wireless service abroad, the same as if you were in the United States. And if that wasn't bad enough, Verizon has also updated its convoluted sliding prices scheme to adjust based on how many phone lines are on a single bill. For instance, families with 4 lines of service, the above unlimited cost is $60 per person. But if you're the only person on the service, the single line cost is $95, which really seems like a marketing ruse, because if everything is supposed to be unlimited, it shouldn't be based on how many people are on the same bill. Well, if somehow your eyes been glazing over what the word unlimited means, hey, join the club. We have Dr. Alfred Poor in a feature segment on wearable and health technologies, in which he's going to talk about artificial intelligence proves 94% accurate at predicting breast cancer complications. He also has a segment on NIH opens enrollment for National All of Us Health Data Research Database. And he's going to be talking about the ASUS demonstration watch that can measure blood pressure in 15 seconds.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Artificial intelligence is all over the news these days, but the things that we're most concerned about is how it applies to health and medical treatment. We've written a lot about artificial intelligence lately. There's a story we did about how an artificial intelligence system was able to diagnose melanoma more accurately than human dermatologists. There have been breakthroughs in diabetes and in stroke management based on data that was generated by artificial intelligence. Well, here's another win for machine learning and AI. The researchers at the Rory Myers College of Nursing in New York have published a story that looked at a problem that sometimes happens with breast cancer patients. It's called lymphedema, and basically what it is the natural flow of lymph fluid gets blocked, and this can lead to uncomfortable to disfiguring and disabling complications. And so it's very important to be able to understand which patients are most at risk for this condition. The researchers looked at a large number of patients. They had over 355 patients in the study, and they looked at their medical histories. Based on that, tried to determine which ones would develop the lymphedema problem. What they actually did was they took 5 different machine learning algorithms and tested them against each other. They found one, which was an artificial neural network, and it had the best results. It was able to predict the lymphedema in almost 94% of the cases. That's a remarkable accuracy rate. So here's another win for big data, another win for artificial intelligence. Computers are going to become important partners for our doctors and healthcare workers as they analyze our health records and give us useful information about our bodies and the most effective treatments that will help us stay healthy longer. The whole thing about artificial intelligence, however, is that you need to have data to work with. Now, imagine your doctor knew everything about how your body worked. What makes it sick? What makes it get better? What keeps it healthy? Now, if they had all that information, they'd be much more effective at diagnosing your illnesses and at determining which treatments are going to be most effective for you. Knowing that kind of information about one person would be helpful, but imagine how much better healthcare could be if we had 1 million people whose data we knew. Well, that's exactly what's going on with a project by the National Institutes of Health called All of Us. We wrote about it last year when this program was put out in beta test, but they have now opened enrollment nationally. You can now go to the All of Us website to sign up and participate. Again, they're looking for 1 million or more volunteers to share their electronic health records and other health information. You only have to be 18 or older. And to join, all you have to do is sign up on the program's website where you fill out an enrollment form and a consent form that will allow them to use your data. You will then be asked to complete some online health surveys. Some participants over time may be asked to come into a participating health center where they're going to take your body measurements and will take blood and urine samples. If you have a personal wearable device like a fitness tracker or smartwatch, they may also ask for you to share the data from that if you want. Now, the important thing about this information is, first of all, they remove your name, your address, any factors that personally identify you. Second, they keep the information in an encrypted database, and only approved researchers will have access to it. Third, you don't have to participate in any specific part of the program if you don't want to. So if you don't want to share your blood or urine samples, you don't have to. If you don't want to share the data from your smartwatch, you don't have to. But if the more information that you share, the more information researchers will have. And the beauty of this system is this will make it possible for thousands of researchers to have access to a large database that will have more instances of different kinds of chronic conditions, different race, different genetic backgrounds, all kinds of different information that you probably wouldn't be able to get in a small sample in a normal study. So this will be a big boon to people who are looking for correlations and commonalities between different kinds of diseases, how diseases interact, how patients respond to different kinds of treatment, and the end result will be that we can all benefit from the much better information about how people get sick and what treatments are most effective. And the end result is that we're going to see more effective treatments, better outcomes, and presumably lower healthcare costs for everyone. So if you're interested, check out the website for all of us. You can find the story on Health Tech Insider for the link. And if you're inclined, sign up, join, and share your data. It's going to help all of us. One piece of information that's very valuable for healthcare workers and others is a patient's blood pressure. It's part of the vital signs that are routinely taken if you go for an office visit or if you're in the hospital, they come around on a regular basis to measure that. And for patients with hypertension, high blood pressure, it's often recommended that they keep track of their blood pressure and measure it throughout the day. The problem is that the most effective units for this are the traditional cuffs that go on your upper arm. They're the ones that squeeze by inflating and then slowly deflate and measure your blood pressure that way. These are generally the most accurate. There are smart units that you can get and use at home that can record the data for you and share it to your smartphone, but they're bulky, they're hard to take with you, and they can be inconvenient. Well, a lot of people are searching for ways to make a smaller, more effective, and convenient blood pressure system. One of the big goals is to find out a way to do it without using the squeezing, the inflating, to put pressure. One promising approach uses both optics, the LEDs to light through your skin and check the reflected information, and ECG, electrocardiography, which measures the electrical currents that come about as a result of your heartbeats. By combining the data from these two different systems, some researchers believe that they can infer your blood pressure by figuring out how fast the wave of pressure in your bloodstream passes through your body. At the Computex trade show in Taiwan earlier this year, Asus, the technology company, demonstrated a early version of a watch that they call the Vivo Watch BP, and BP stands for blood pressure. That uses this combination of optical sensors and ECG electrical sensors for the heartbeats. They say that they can get an accurate result in just 15 seconds. The watch also tracks heart rate, sleep quality, and counts steps, as you'd expect most fitness devices would do. It also has a built-in GPS, and it says it will run for 28 days on a single battery charge. Now, sales of the watch are supposed to start in Asia later this July. However, the company doesn't expect to have it for sale in the U.S. until the second or third quarter of next year. The company is seeking FDA approval for it, and we'll have to get all that in place first before they can go ahead and sell it in the U.S. We'll be watching closely and to see just how accurate this is, how it stacks up against the gold standards of blood pressure measurers. But if they can deliver on this promise, we could end up with a wrist device that can measure your blood pressure quickly, accurately, and easily.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. The evolution in website design tools. In the early 1990s, most websites were designed with HTML coding. By the end of 1993, there were 623 websites, according to a study by MIT researcher Matthew Gray. The internet was taking off, and so was the design of websites. By mid-1994, there were over 2,700 websites, and by the end of the year, there were over 10,000 websites. The birth of browsers that could display images was the first step into web design as we know it. The closest option available to structure information was the concept of tables, already existing in HTML. So putting tables within tables, figuring out clever ways to mix static cells with fluid cells was the thing. The future of the web was shaping quickly. JavaScript helped designers overcome the limitations of the static HTML by allowing them to bring some motion to the web. This gave birth to the pop-up window. Yeah, I know, that's the one that's giving everyone problems. The problem is that it has to load on top of the existing page, which causes sites to load slower. Designers would make a fancy layout, but it was up to the developers to break it into small pieces and figure out the best way to make that design work. It was also the time when so many developers decided to not like front-end coding. Internet users more than doubled in the year 1996 to 36 million users worldwide. In 1996, we saw the number of websites grow from over 25,000 to over 250,000. Flash changed the landscape of website design. For the first time, designers could create any shape, add animation, and develop more engaging sites than ever before using one single tool. EndPage would compact all of the information into a single file to be loaded. The main issue was that not every web user had a Flash plugin installed, and Flash sites took much longer to load. The age of Flash brought us splash pages and animated intros. While Flash is still being used today, its downfall came from the lack of being search-friendly and its heavy consumption of processing power, and Apple left it behind in 2007 in its release of the iPhone. The internet in 1998 started to look a little more like the internet we see today. Google Beta went live in September 4, 1998. Shortly after the creation of Flash, cascading style sheets, that's CSS, made its way onto the scene. As more and more users were going online, speed was becoming a big issue. The thought behind CSS is simple: separate content and presentation. The content of the site was in the HTML, and the style of the site would be coded in CSS. The early struggle for CSS was the result of poor browser support. Luckily, it fought through the early years, and it's still in full use today. CSS may be the most important language a web designer needs to know. While Y2K brought fear of potential meltdown, the year also ushered in a whole new way of doing business. PayPal, you've heard of that. The world's leading online payment company, started in 1999, but it was the year 2000 that PayPal really took off. Y2K was also a great year for web development. As more and more businesses were going online, having a great-looking website was starting to become more of the way of doing business, and it was becoming a need for each business. Up until the year 2000, website design was much more of a technical field handled by the company's IT department. In 2003, all that changed. WordPress, which is now the world's leading content management system, that's CMS, was launched in 2003, and it's estimated that it's been installed on approximately 2,000 blogs as of May 2003, and as of January 2015, 23.3% of the top 10 million websites now use WordPress. WordPress is a free CMS based on PHP and MySQL. Features include a plugin architecture and a template system.
MySpace became a place for users to create their own profiles and connect with other online users. But even more, they allowed their users access to HTML editors in order to customize their profiles. Many aspiring web designers got their early exposure to HTML using the MySpace platform. While Facebook originally launched in 2004 alongside of MySpace, it was reserved only for college students, and you had to have an EDU mail address to even gain access to it. In 2006, Facebook went public and changed social media and how the public used the internet altogether. While MySpace allowed users to custom code their pages, Facebook opted not to give their user this ability. It led to a simple, consistent look throughout the network. Facebook focuses their design around their brand. Everything about their network said something about Facebook. Yeah, we know that today. Today, Facebook is the most visited site in the United States and has over 1 billion users worldwide. This is done with a simple, clean-cut, and branded web design. Mobile devices and smartphones have changed the way people use and think about the web. In 2007, most sites were not mobile-friendly by any standard. Furthermore, using the web on a mobile device was very frustrating. This forced web designers to create a better approach to mobile web design. This new frontier posed many questions. Should a mobile site be scaled down? Should we create standards for mobile? How do we speed it up so that users don't waste time gathering their data? The answer came in the form of the 960 grid. Bootstrap and Foundation became the base for the new mobile web world. On June 29, 2007, the first iPhone was released. This new product ushered in a new era in web design. While users had been surfing the web on very basic browsers prior to the invention of the smartphone, most found it to be frustrating and unnecessary. While Apple didn't invent the smartphone, they did make it mainstream. Apple has always been known for their products and their design. In 2007, they showcased their brand online with this smart and simple design. By the end of that first decade of the new millennia, the internet had saturated every part of our culture. Flickr was named one of Time's 50 best websites of 2009. It was created by Yahoo. Flickr gave people a place to store and share their photos online. Flickr was the first site to use collaborative tagging. The idea is that if everyone is allowed to tag everyone else's uploaded photos, then a rough and ready categorization would naturally emerge from the wisdom of the crowd. This is what made Flickr. As mobile internet use increased, mobile design became number one. In 2010, a brilliant and driven web designer, instead of creating a separate mobile site, he proposed that the same content could be used, but in different layouts and design, depending on the screen size. This was the birth of responsive design. From a technical viewpoint, we still use HTML and CSS, so it's rather a conceptual advancement. The main benefit of responsive design is the content parity, meaning that it's the same website everywhere. The holy grail of web design has been to actually make it visual and bring it into the browser. Imagine that the designer simply moves things around the screen and a clean code comes out. And I don't mean changing the order of things, but having full flexibility and control. Imagine that developers don't have to worry about browser compatibility and can focus on the actual problem solving. WordPress is the world's most popular content management system. Originally launched as a blogging platform back in 2003, WordPress now powers 29% of all websites and controls a massive 60% of the known content management system market. Drupal has been around even longer than WordPress. Though it lacks WordPress' gaudy market share, it was originally launched in 2000. Drupal powers 2.3% of all websites and has a 4.6% of the content management system market. There are more than a million websites today. While today's websites are built using much of the same code language of the 90s, the process evolved, with a tremendous difference. With so much competition on the internet, websites have to be hyper-focused around their users in order to stay relevant. At the latest count, there are over 1.8 billion websites on the World Wide Web today. Of these, however, only 200 million are active. The internet has grown massively with websites.
Creating a website 101. Let's say you want to set up a personal website. Designing websites is one way of getting into an information technology job without expending a great expense for a college education. This in turn can lead into developing websites for mom and pop businesses where they don't have the time to set up and maintain their own website. You may want to start first with the setup of your own website where you can gain the experience of uploading pictures and files and videos for your family and friends to see. Where would you start? Creating your own website is a fairly streamlined process that you do not need a lot of technical prowess to get it up and running. You do need to get an available domain name for your future site, but registration companies like register.com and namecheat.com will set up the domain name of your choice for a small fee. There are two things needed to start your own website: a unique domain name. A domain name is the address where internet users can access your website. A domain name is used for finding and identifying computers on the internet. Computers use IP addresses, which are a series of numbers. However, it is difficult for humans to remember a string of numbers. An example is, instead of a string of numbers, we use pcradioshow.org. What's the difference between .com, .net, .org, and you've seen .gov, which is .gov, and .edu? Each of these is what is called a top-level domain, or TLD. Domains ending with .com are generally intended for use for commercial businesses, which is why they're the most commonly seen domains in the United States. Domains ending with .net are usually intended for networking services and internet service providers, such as Comcast or AT&T residential email addresses. For instance, an AT&T employee who also use AT&T for their home service would use name@att.com for their business email, but name@att.net for their residential address. .org domains are usually intended for nonprofit organizations. However, there's nothing legally preventing anyone from using a .org or .org domain for a for-profit business, nor a .net domain for a nonprofit group. Many companies snap up all three variants in order to help protect their branding. A .net extension would be the last choice, as it has the disadvantage of a lower Google ranking weight compared to a .com or a .org extension. Well, you also need a hosting site. What do you mean by a hosting site? In a sense, you rent space on a computer to hold your website. Your host, the computer where your website files are stored, assigns an address, DNS, for your files and for your domain name so that anyone can find your website on the internet by typing in your domain name. Many of these same companies may also sell you a package deal, so along with the domain name, you might get some modest or full service space to host your site and tools to create your own web page and tech support. For instance, register.com has such a thing called Do-It-Myself Web Design Package, and that starts at under $13 a month, and it includes a few other perks like email addresses for the site. Running your own website for family and friends to visit gives you a lot of control, but it can also be a lot of work. If you mainly want to share family news, videos, and photos options, like, there are options like Shutterfly, Share, Zalongo, or Family Crossing that provides server space and tools you need, and they're geared more for smaller groups of viewers. Depending on the software and services your family members are using, sharing content through sites like iCloud, Dropbox, Google Drive, Microsoft OneDrive, and similar sites may also be used, and they do work. Keep one thing in mind, though, for whichever method you select, because you are sharing private family photos and details, consider using a site or service that lets you easily password protect your content from outside people peeking into it. There are website design tools. WordPress versus Drupal. Choosing between two website design platforms. Released only a couple of years apart, WordPress and Drupal are big players in the CMS market, but WordPress has gained a lot more popularity over the years.
Its user base is almost 10 times of that of DrupalPal. But is it 10 times better? The answer in the WordPress versus DrupalPal discussion really comes down to the level of skill. And, well, DrupalPal has more features that are brilliant, but if you know how to use them, fine, but useless and confusing if you don't. Which is the better tool to develop a website? This is like asking the question, which was better, Betamax or VHS? Is the more technically proficient product better than the product that has the dominant market share? Well, let's look at some of the details. Ease of use. The edge goes to WordPress. Customizing options. Obviously, there's more in DrupalPal, so the edge goes to DrupalPal. And as a developer, in terms of job opportunity, well, DrupalPal has a smaller pool of knowledgeable people, so it's less competitive. It is offset by a smaller pool of potential clients. Security. DrupalPal has enterprise-level security and provides in-depth security reports. Hence, while you'll find governments, such as the White House, as well as major enterprise corporations such as New York Times and CNN using it, that's the advantage, and that's the edge. Overall, developers take to DrupalPal because it is powerful and flexible, so they can work the magic on it and create their own solutions. On the other side of the ledger, bloggers and small businesses that don't have the knowledge or time and want something really simple to use will opt for WordPress. It's perhaps for this reason the larger proportion of bloggers and small businesses and those who pay developers prefer WordPress, as it has many more downloads than DrupalPal. And the winner of this discussion is? Well, I'll leave it up to you to make your own final decision, as you need to consider where you think you'll be in the future. And for those who think that they are quite confident in their technical abilities, hey, the choice is easy. You'll handle both. It's like being able to drive in Hong Kong in the morning and take the same car over to the mainland China in the afternoon. One drives on the left side of the road, and in the mainland China, you drive on the right side of the road. And people don't get confused by that if they have to drive between places with two different regulations.
Marty Winston is going to be talking about the House of 1,000 Switches. Because in a cybernetic house, a switch is any on or off binary input that can talk to the master control system. Some of them are standard wall switches, reconfigured to be, well, data inputs. Some are magnetic read switches at room and closet and exterior doors. Some are transistors in opto-isolators that detect the presence of power in anything from wall outlets to self-automated exhaust fans. And some are water ropes that switch on and off when they get wet. At least hundreds of switches, if not really 1,000. And Marty will now explain all of this in simple English.
Will our cybernetic house have 1,000 switches? It might come close. And that's something that became more apparent as I was tightening down on the interface specification for the 30 mid-ceiling cap control nodes around the house. Some of those switches aren't what you may normally think of as switches, so let me share a little about how I think about what's happening. In the neighborhood where I grew up, several of us tinkered with electronics for fun. I built lots of kits and tried a few times, not always successfully, to design and build my own projects, or to duplicate the projects in the newsstand electronics magazines. Years later, I'd be writing a lot of those articles, so I did get better. But I want to go back to a really inspiring guy and still my best friend, Al Roberts. Al would beat the garbage truck on its rounds, in a practice my dad used to call curbside shopping. He'd take electronic discards home, disassemble them for parts, and organize the parts into cans and boxes. There was also an electronic surplus store downtown that had its own treasure troves. And Olsen Radio had a junk table always worth exploring. I won't comment on anything childish or illegal we may have done, but the gang of us was pretty good at finding uses for things. One thing that Al did stuck with me. He took a power transformer, a micro switch, and an indicator light and rigged them so that if anybody opened the door to the basement, which was his hangout and ours, the light would turn on. That was an actual switch, a mechanical device that made two conductors connect as the result of a mechanical action. We'll be using some of those, but not quite the kind you may anticipate and not quite in the way you may anticipate. For example, we are not directly connecting power to our light and fan wall switches. That's true for, maybe one or two. But we do want our switches to look like switches, even though they operate like computer input keys. Here's what I mean by that. Those rectangular wall switches or outlet pairs that you see in so many places are commonly referred to as decor style or decorator style. There is one specific kind of switch, one that's usually used to operate a garbage disposer, that looks like the other switches, but its operation is momentary. It's only on for as long as you push it on. So electrically, it's the same kind of actuation you might expect from a buzzer button or a car horn. In our case, as is the case for all of the switches in this project, it's only switching a few hundredths of a milliamp of current through a 100K pull-up resistor connected to 3.3 volts. To put that another way, it's handling a lot less power than a pocket pen light. Heck, it would take 3,000 of these to burn a tenth of a watt. But that's all it needs to trigger an I/O pin change on a Raspberry Pi or on the multiplexed switch inputs we add to it. Remember, our automation could do a really good job without switches of making all of the on and off and dimming actions happen, but I also recognize that people expect switches and there's no reason to abandon that control. Besides, we can get the switches to do tricks. Just tap the switch and lighting can toggle between on and off. Hold it in for more than a second and it can start making the lights dimmer or brighter in the opposite direction of the last time that happened. Hold it in for half a second, then release it very briefly, and it will let you tap in some specific kinds of instructions, like tagging a room that's been vacant as becoming occupied, or sneakily telling the house there's an indoor threat so the automation can call the police and unlock the doors. Those decor switches are there for people to operate, but they're far from the only switches. Every exterior door, every bedroom and bathroom and pantry and closet door has a magnet hidden in the top of the door and a hidden magnetic reed switch embedded in the door frame, a slightly neater installation of the trick my old friend Al had done. Like a traditional switch, a magnetic reed switch works by getting two conductors to connect, but instead of a mechanical element making that happen, it happens in the presence of a magnetic field, simple, silent, and reliable. And just like the other switches, they're wired to 100K pull-up resistors to 3.3 volt supply, and they let the computer know whether the door is closed or not closed. Door status is important for a few reasons. One is that our comfort system controls let us orchestrate the HVAC system airflow across the house, even at a room-by-room basis. If there's an unused bedroom, it makes no sense to hold it to exactly the same comfort standard as the rest of the house, so we more or less relax the thermostat for those rooms. But an open door is a big air leak that works against that. Even that is useful. Leaving the door to a vacant room open for 20 to 30 minutes or longer is one way to tell the house that you expect it to soon be occupied and to make that room more comfortable. The control system can also identify shorter visits to vacuum or to get something out of a closet, for example, and not a reason for changing the vacant status of the room. Doors opening or closing also provide important information to enhance the warm body tracking that helps control lighting and other things, especially near transition points. For example, you can move all around a room with a closed door without ever needing a light in the hall. But if you're in the room at the door and the door opens or is open, it makes sense to light up the hall. And if you're in the hall and approach and open the door, it makes sense to light up the room. By the way, mechanical switches and reed switches both experience contact bounce, where the conductors rattle against each other when you first connect them. We didn't want that to be something for software to handle because it would use too many cycles. So we debounce in hardware, meaning something very simple, a 0.1 microfarad tantalum capacitor from the GPIO pin to ground. For you audio or radio guys, because of that 100K pull-up resistor, it becomes a low-pass filter. There's another kind of switch, called, among other things, a water rope. Its resistance dramatically changes when it's wet, and a simple interface circuit can turn that resistance change into an on or off to report to the control system. These water ropes respond to water anywhere along their length, so we can string them under faucet and drain connections at sinks or tanks, for example, and quickly know when something leaked and needs attention. That's one example of an electronic condition triggering the on-off reading. There are several other places where we use a component called an optoisolator. It's essentially a light-emitting diode inside the same case as a phototransistor with no electrical connection between them. When something lights up the LED, that turns on the transistor, and the transistor acts as the switch. I can use these to monitor power outlets, so I can tell whether or not they have power. Remember, my control system is independently powered. If all the outlets are unpowered, either there's an outage or something tripped the master at the breaker box. If selected outlets are not powered, it means either a tripped breaker or a wiring fault, usually either a loose connection or a suicidal squirrel. A single outlet location being bad could mean a bad outlet, a wiring fault, or a GFCI event. This multiple outlet monitoring gives us essentially instant awareness of those circumstances. By the way, we have something even more jarring than contact bounce to worry about. The input to the optoisolator is a current-limited connection to the AC power line. And we use an optoisolator with two LEDs inside, wired in reverse polarity to each other, so they fire on both plus and minus cycles of the power line. The phototransistor sees that as 120 activations per second. It takes a bigger capacitor, but we can also filter that out, down to just power present or power absent, and still know about power failures within about a tenth of a second. We can also hack the bathroom exhaust fans, the ones that over showers that get triggered by rising humidity, or the ones over toilets that use passive infrared to detect motion, and then they each run for some number of minutes longer to keep the air clear. Don't you try this at home, but we can connect directly into the internal motor wiring that gets switched on and read its status the same way we read the status of a power outlet. Remember, we don't do warm body tracking inside bathrooms. But between these signals and adjacent room tracking and doors, the house can intelligently guess where you've gone without following you in. So it's a lot like being married. It's a little more complex at the 10 mid-wall recessed outlets designed specifically to be places to plug in TV sets, because the sets are drawing a little bit of power in standby mode even when they're turned off. We figured out a design that switches only when the power draw through the outlet is more than 25 to 30 watts. Again, using an optoisolator, but also using a really old circuit trick called a clamp. I won't get into that here. Want to get exotic? We can talk about the driveway, where a buried dual coil senses the presence and direction of massive metal things like cars. And a dual infrared photoelectric beam brake sensor does the same for anything crossing the driveway. Those ultimately act like switches. There's a dual technology sensor over the front door using both passive infrared and ultrasonics to tell us when there's something there, and it acts like a switch. But there are tons of virtual switches, like when the surveillance cameras are triggered by movements in what they see, or when the Bluetooth beacon receivers detect one of our cars coming in, and that kind of thing. Switches are wonderful. Compared to sensors that read ranges of values and then require processing time to deal with that, the simple switch, whether a traditional switch or a circuitry that acts as if it were a simple switch presents automation with an ability to respond more quickly. It's simply on or off. It's binary serving binary. But did you notice, in many of these applications, these simple switches aren't our only way of being able to know what's going on. We try to never depend on any single thing to keep atop what we need to know. So just like power, just like data, we back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Schedule computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on What's a router and why do I want one? Thursday, June the 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, July the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium, located in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, July 5th at 7 p.m. The topic of presentation is The Secret History of Silicon Valley. They'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club will meet on Thursday, July the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. NYU Silver Building, room 405, located in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, July the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They'll meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane. They'll meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, July the 24th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, well, they have no meetings on July and August, but they'll resume meeting again in September. September the 7th, meeting time is 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Barter Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey, and we'll have more information on that at a later date. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings. At these club meetings, there is a random access period in which you can ask questions. And if you're a newbie user or going to a club first time or you have some technical questions, many of the members will be more than happy to help you. And just remember, there's no such thing as a dumb computer question.
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup is very important for your data. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week. Stay safe and healthy and enjoy the summer.